Hi, I'm Susan Weisbauer, co-author of The Well-Trained Mind.
And I'm Susanna Jarrett, editor at The Well-Trained Mind Press. And we're talking about education for all parents and for all children in all sorts of settings. Today's episode was actually inspired by one of our listeners who sent us an email. And I'm going to just kind of summarize some of the parts of this email for you to get this discussion started. So our listener wrote, "In the years since my children were in the grammar stage, I've grown a lot and had my eyes open to troubling elements in many books that are considered classics for the grammar stage. For example, Little House on the Prairie for its depiction of Native Americans." And then she goes through a few other examples. She said that these books and others are on the Story of the World activity books. Have those lists been updated? I've recently been reading articles and lists of books, goes into some new books she's finding. And then she finishes, "I don't think the grammar stage is not the right stage at which students should be asked to identify harmful stereotypes. I believe that comes later. I would love to hear your thoughts about this."
Oh my goodness, this is such a big question. And you know, I think we've all had the experience of revisiting books that we loved as a child and thinking, hang on there.
I don't remember that.
I don't remember that. Something is not good here. You know, I just say from a really personal level that, now I'm going to anger a bunch of our listeners. Sorry, Susanna. I had this experience also just even as an adult returning to C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy, which I had loved when I was a teenager, so not even so much a child. And I remember I went back when I was in my late 30s or early 40s and reread That Hideous Strength. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, this is the most misogynistic book I have ever read. Look at all of these assumptions about what women are and what women should be doing. I can't believe I loved this book so much, you know. So,
but it didn't bother you as a young woman, which is so fascinating.
It didn't bother me as a young woman, but, and I think this is what the question is going to come down to, I do question, because I loved Lewis so much, still do, he was a man of his times. I'm old enough to realize that. And I loved that series so much. And it was so beautifully written and so imaginative. I think I absorbed a fair amount from that book of how I should be viewing myself as a woman, which now I think was probably not helpful.
Interesting. Well, it doesn't make me mad because I've never read it. I'm not attached to that particular series. So you're safe here. We might get some angry emails. But I have a similar experience with Little House. And that's a book that we'll use as an example for this conversation as we're kind of this season, we're getting into the nitty gritties of different subjects. And so diving into the nitty gritties of literature and how to use it. But I loved the Little House series growing up. And I don't just mean like my mom read it to me. I mean, I read all the books multiple times, bought myself a bonnet, wore it regularly. One time we were going to a church conference in Minnesota and I somehow convinced the whole family to road trip out like an hour to pilgrimage to one of her houses. I was the biggest Laura Ingalls Wilder fan that you may have ever met. And so, of course, I always assumed that I would be sharing these stories with my own children someday. And now I'm grappling with it because in the context of preparing for this episode, I was starting to look back at Little House on the Prairie for the first time in years. And I was like, oh, wow, I don't remember that. Ooh, okay. I don't remember that either. Yeah. And even, you know, I'm getting ready to have my first daughter and she's going to be a quarter Native American. My husband is half Mohawk. And so trying to think about how do I introduce these stories to her? Do I introduce these stories to her? So as we're having this conversation, I'm kind of grappling with this personally as well. So I'm excited to dive in here.
And, you know, and I think too, we're going to have to, I mean, first of all, so the big question is here, classic books, objectionable content. Mm-hmm. Do we ban them? Mm-hmm. Do we edit or censor them? Mm-hmm. I don't think we need to go as far as burning them. Do we read them? And if so, how do we read them? How should we tackle them? So, I mean, I think we need to actually start by defining objectionable content. Mm-hmm. So let me give you a couple of examples and people can feel free to disagree with me, of things that I personally don't find objectionable content. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking, for example, of Frances Hodgson Burnett's A Little Princess. Mm-hmm. One of the most wonderful classics, especially for girls. I mean, it's just this, you know, she's privileged and then she gets thrown down into poverty and then magic happens. You know, it's just the most lovely. Well, there is, I'm sorry if I'm ruining this for someone who hasn't read it, but a gentleman, an old gentleman sort of discovers her and decides to become her benefactor. And one of the ways that he does that is that while she's sleeping, his Indian servant and his Indian servant's monkey visit her bedroom and light a fire and bring her food. And it's like she goes to sleep in this cold garret and she wakes up with a fire and food and warm blankets. And it's just the most fairy tale thing that mm-hmm. you would hope would happen. Now, in some way, you could say this is a stereotypical depiction, because, mm-hmm. you know, this is an Indian servant who's being sent by his British colonial master to serve another white person. Mm-hmm. However, the Indian servant is given a name. Mm-hmm. He's given a title. He's called Mister. He, while he is carrying out his, he does have a master, this, you know, British colonial officer, while he's carrying out his master's wishes, he does so and expresses his own desire, his own thoughts, his own wish to do well by this little girl. So the sort of the surrounding description of him does have stereotypes, like the monkey, for example. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he's a fully developed character. And the book takes place at a time when there were a lot of, you know, British ex-officers who had come back to London with Indian servants. It's just, right. you know, it's just a historical reality.
Right. No, I think that's an example of where this is a tricky place to navigate, because we're going to talk about examples of things that really are quite objectionable and how mm-hmm. to cover that. But I do think it's easy to go too far. And it kind of reminds me, last year there was a big tizzy with Roald Dahl, the Roald Dahl Foundation, mm-hmm. Hiring sensitivity editors to go back through most of his works and change, make a lot of edits. And some of them were edits for like very specific racial stereotypes. And some of them were just words that some people might be offended by, like fat or crazy.
Right. So actually, I want to read you a few examples, okay. if I may, because these all were things that I would not consider to be reasons to keep a child from reading a book. So in the BFG, which is the Big Friendly Giant, you've gone white as a sheet. Well, apparently it's not okay to say somebody's white, even though we're talking about a sheet. I don't know. Right. Which has now become, you've gone still as a statue, and the BFG can't wear a black cloak. So they basically pulled out the adjectives white and black.
Right.
In James and the Giant Peach, there's cloud men who have become cloud people. Aunt Sponge is described as the fat one, and they mm-hmm. take all of the descriptions of her being fat out of the box. And this is my favorite one. There's Roald Dahl. Okay, I am not a big Roald Dahl fan. I found him quite disturbing for other reasons. However, there's a reference in his book The Witches to the fact that witches are bald and wear wigs.
Right.
And then the sensitivity editors actually put in a line he didn't write. There are plenty of other reasons why women might wear wigs, and there is certainly nothing wrong with that. You know, so right. at some point you have to be like, well, okay, people are fat and wear wigs and go white, and can we not
accept that?
Accept that?
Right. And this is a silly example, because Roald Dahl was sort of a silly author in some ways. He has a lot of silly descriptions of people, but the in general, like, the world is a place with all of this stuff in it that children are going to encounter one way or the other. And just taking words like fat out of a book isn't going to change the world they live in, the things that they hear. Mm-hmm. It's just, it seems like we're trying to overprotect kids at this point and changing right. books to that degree, adding whole trying justifications for why women might wear wigs, just seems like a great example of going way too far.
Yeah. So, but let's compare that with, and I hope our readers won't mind if I give some actual examples of, because if you're going to read Little House on the Prairie, these mm-hmm. things are going to be in there. There's, you know, three things have come up, for example, in Little House on the Prairie. The narrator writes, unironically, there were no people, only Indians lived there.
Right. Which I actually think that particular line was edited before Lauren Goes Wilder died. Mm. So now it says there are no settlers, only Indians live there. So that would be an example of Roald Dahl actually
Yep.
Before Roald Dahl died, the Oompa Loompas in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory were based off of an African tribe, and he changed that before he died. So some of these more egregious examples have already been changed many years ago in the 50s and 60s.
So did they eliminate the part where Pa says the only good Indian is a dead Indian? I'm sorry, guys. I didn't write it.
I actually was looking for it when I read it, when I was going through it today, and I didn't see it. There's a place where the neighbor says that, and Pa says, I would never agree with that, in the context of talking about how they had a friend who was, I think it was a Osage man, mm-hmm. who was kind of convincing the other native peoples in that area not to fight against the settlers. And so Pa says, I'll never agree with Mr. So-and-so who says, and the only good Indian is a dead Indian. That is still in the book, but he's disagreeing with it. And it's interesting because Ma and Pa's a little bit, Pa and Laura are a little bit more curious and friendly with the native men that come through the house, whereas Ma is more like, oh, I just wish they'd all disappear, you know, that type of attitude.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking back at my experience with the books, I definitely came away from them with a sense of Indians as threatening, ignorant, and dirty. Is that fair?
Yeah. There's a lot of descriptions, where they're called wild and things like that.
Yeah. So is that something that we should expose our children to? This is the big question. So I guess we've sort of identified sort of two different ways to approach this, Susanna.
Yeah. And there's actually, I'm going to link this in the show notes. There's some really interesting articles. And I found one, it's an opinion piece in the Washington Post that talks to different people. And so I'll link in the show notes and you can see maybe more articulate responses or sides of this argument. But I think in general, there's a side of folks saying, we have better books now. You know, why would we read Little House when there is a better alternative available? We should just leave that in the past. And then maybe when kids are a bit older, maybe middle of high school, they could use it as kind of a primary source to examine racist attitudes of the past. But we shouldn't be teaching it to little kids as a story.
So we'll talk about the pros and cons of that point of view. But then what's the other approach?
The other approach is that these books offer a lot of value, literary value, teachable moments, and that we should continue to use them and just confront these things head on and have conversations with their kids as we're reading, but not throw them out because of moments where they, you know, characters have conversations that are historically accurate for the time.
Yeah. And you've got this wonderful quote from Philip Knell in the Washington Post, where he says, racist classics of children's literature, and that's a lot of them, by the way, read in context can provide an opportunity for education. And I love this. If you're going to read the problematic books, don't read the cleaned up version. Mm-hmm. Read the book and talk about what's wrong with it. Children need to learn that it's okay to argue with the book or even get angry at a book.
Yeah, I love that too.
So I feel like what is really behind a lot of the impulse to remove books from school libraries or remove books from public libraries so that children can't get their hands on them is this idea that, I don't know, that you can't get angry with the book, that you don't have the power to get angry with the book. I actually think we've talked about this before, Susanna, although I can't remember when, so maybe our listeners will remember, but to treat a book in that way, as though it's so dangerous that you can't even let a child take it off the shelf and open it, is what I would call a really pre-literate approach to books, that it's a magic object with a power that can't be resisted, that it's going to like sort of suck you into it and you won't be able to do anything about it.
Right.
And that's something that a magical object does, not a book. A book is an argument. And so I love this idea that you teach children that it's okay to read something and be like, eh, no, I don't buy that.
Right. That it's not the end all be all truth teller, even that you can disagree with a book from a young age. That's setting them up for doing more analysis in the logic and rhetoric stage. If you're reading the book and, you know, Ma says something and it's like, maybe that wasn't a very nice thing for Ma to say, or maybe that wasn't a very accurate thing for Ma to say. Mm-hmm. It's setting them up to think about those types of things as they're learning how to do deeper analysis later on.
So I feel like that you and I are actually sort of both sort of zeroing in on the same perspective, which is right. that we're not huge fans of throwing out all the books with problematic content. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say, and this is actually, this is a literary judgment mm-hmm. from someone who reads a lot of books. Newer books, yes, very often have more accurate depictions of groups that we are not part of, that we, mm-hmm. and you and I, you know, you and I are both white. So there is great value in reading a story, a novel, a picture book that has been written and illustrated by someone who is part of a group that we're not part of. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem from a literary point of view. The classics have survived because they're great stories. Mm-hmm. They're gripping, they're engaging, they're vivid. They are wonderful examples of the classical story arc where a hero or a heroine faces problems and conflicts in order to achieve a goal and fights to struggle to achieve the goal and then achieves the goal. And then there's an aftermath, you know, that story right. arc that has governed all great stories since the Odyssey. And a lot of times I personally find that newer books, particularly those that seem to have been produced with an eye to let me represent an underrepresented population, mm-hmm. fall a little flat on the narrative side, right? On the artistic right. side, because writing really good stories is hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, in every generation, there are only a few people who really get it right. So my concern would be that by keeping classics like, we'll just keep using Little House on the Prairie as an example, out of the hands of children because we're, you know, we're worried about the harmful stereotypes without diminishing the harm, is that they're also missing the great storytelling. And that's mm-hmm. not something that can easily be replaced with much newer, much more modern books.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think it's important to take note that these stories are part of our literary canon. They're part of our cultural knowledge. And if we start to toss them out, you're going to find, as you mentioned already, that when you go down that road, a lot of these books are going to have something or another that you have to address with kids, things that are objectionable. And so you kind of have to learn how to do it, or you're going to be ending up throwing out all classic literature almost.
I know so many books. I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird mm-hmm. is gone. You know, there's just so many books that are gone.
I was just reading, for whatever reason, The Secret Garden recently. And there mm-hmm. was parts of it I was like, I do not remember this, but I can't believe what she just said.
And were these so, racial? Yeah. I haven't read that yeah. one recently.
The Secret Garden, she was, somebody thought that the main character was Indian. I think she'd gotten a tan or something. And just her reaction right. to that was so very... she was so angry and she couldn't believe that someone would think that. And some of the things she said in that context were quite rude. Well, just more than rude. But yeah. anyway, I don't remember the exact quote, but it shocked me. So anyway, there's a lot of stuff in these classic books. However, like you said, they still hold a lot of value. And so throwing the baby out with the bathwater, to use a cliche, I think is not the best way to do this. But I think we can dive in here to... how do we do it? How do we do it, especially as our listener mentioned in the email, in the grammar stage when kids are so young? How do mm-hmm. we go about reading books with objectionable content?
And, you know, also, well, okay, of course, you're the parent. You know, mm-hmm. we should say this to our yeah. listeners. You're the parent. You know your kid. Kids vary widely in yes. what they pick up.
Yeah.
And you should probably have a good idea of what your child might absorb that you don't want them to absorb because they're uncritical, or what they might find disturbing mm-hmm. And upsetting that you don't want to expose them to. So you should always be the final arbiter of what your child does or doesn't read. But, you know, there are, I would say, at least three good reasons why even in the grammar stage, we shouldn't completely protect our children from mm-hmm. these books. And, you know, and I think the first one is just that the world is not a safe and fair place.
Right.
Right. And so when you're reading these books, even with a grammar stage child, reading those books together, the child reading them in your home when you're there to answer questions, is actually a safe place for them to begin to understand that people do not and have never treated each other fairly. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that Ma reacts to the Indians is not good. It's not fair. It's not just. Well, believe it or not, your child may already have figured out that in the world today, people don't respond to them fairly and justly, right? So, you know, this is actually a great way for kids to begin to, I don't know, cope with, experience in a manageable manner, the dark side of the world that they're already somewhat familiar with because they live in the world.
Absolutely. I lived a pretty sheltered childhood, and I feel like literature was one of the ways that helped prepare me for the world I live in. Now I'm an adult and I'm out and about in the world. And there's a lot of things I didn't do as a kid that maybe other kids did. But I think that reading books and learning about humanity, all sides of humanity, was helpful for me to not be as naive as I might have been. I mean, reading the classics, that's the heart of the classics is humanity, is the story of human beings and how they interact. And like you said, the world is not a safe place. Sheltering children from, you know, mean characters and bad things in books is ultimately refusing them a safe opportunity to kind of be introduced to those things.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think the second reason that we had here that is important is that you can also fall very easily and quickly into the temptation of omission. So let's say you're a well-meaning white parent, you're worried about saying the wrong thing, you don't know a lot about a certain country or a certain group, maybe say a Native American nation that you're studying, or maybe even Native Americans in general. You feel like you're not qualified to talk about it because you don't know enough. And so if you're homeschooling and then you're tempted to just avoid the topic because you don't want to say something wrong, well, then, you know, then you're missing out on something really, really important. So we want to not fall into the temptation of omitting these difficult conversations that we should be having with our kids, even though they're tricky and even though we feel like we're not qualified. So, for example, if you're studying American history, you don't let your kids read Little House because the characters say racist things. And then you move through your history of, you know, the West and the colonization of the Americas without talking about Native Americans, without talking about racist attitudes towards Native Americans, without talking about settlers and the conflict. I think Little House on the Prairie is actually the central conflict of that story is really them moving into a place where there were already people there and who's going to leave. Are they going to leave or are the Native Americans going to leave? So never addressing that conflict, you end up with these sanitized account of history where your children never learn about what really happened and how we really, how this country got from sea to shining sea, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not inevitable.
Yeah. And those attitudes still exist. I mean, I live in Southeastern Virginia. I love my home. I love my county. My county is majority Black, a smaller percentage minority white, and then a healthy but still smaller percentage of Chickahominy Indian. And in my particular county, it's Chickahominy Eastern Division. And I am here to tell you, because I've lived here my whole life, that the ways in which people talk about each other mirror some of the worst things that you would read in Little House of the Prairie books.
You know,
these attitudes have not gone away. I wish they had, but encountering them in a book is, to sort of return to our first point, a safe way for kids to realize that these attitudes exist and that they're wrong, but they existed and still exist. It's once you're, you know, you're aware of the prejudice that, for example, many white people might have towards Native Americans, if you encounter it for the first time in Little House in the Prairie, as opposed to at the grocery store, I think it's a little simpler to guide the child's reaction to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Or to have that conversation in that moment. Versus it being somebody that they talk to in the grocery store, or maybe a grandparent or something, something more personal to them. than a story.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So with these three reasons, you know, not overprotecting our kids, not falling into the temptation of omission, and noting that these attitudes still exist, I think what that all comes to is that these are conversations that we can have in the grammar stage. And these are books that we can still enjoy with our children, and not merely as analysis later in high school, but as they are kids and as they're enjoying the stories, we can stop and have these conversations. And we're going to talk about how to do that. We have three tips for reading classic literature in the grammar stage. But before that, we're going to take a super quick break. Don't go anywhere. When we're back, we have more important tips for reading classic literature in the grammar stage.
Looking for audiobooks and stories that your children will love and you won't get sick of hearing, even after the 15th time? Well-Trained Mind Press offers over 75 audio titles, from bedtime stories to myths and legends from around the world, to fascinating tales of great men and women from throughout history, to unabridged performances of classic books like The Wizard of Oz and My Father's Dragon. Available at welltrainedmind.com or wherever you purchase audiobooks. On the Well-Trained Mind website, use the code PODCAST to get a 15% discount on any items not already discounted.
All right, everyone. So we talked a little bit about why we think that we should be reading classic literature in the grammar stage, even if there is objectional content in it. Obviously, like Susan said earlier, you know your child. You know the sensitivity of your child. So all of these are just principles and ideas. At the end of the day, you're the parent, and that's the beautiful part of it. Not only, especially as a homeschool parent, you can kind of know your child to know what they're ready for. But here's some things to get us started. We have three tips for reading literature in the grammar stage. And the first one I would say is to read it out loud with your kids, mm-hmm. because that gives you the time and the space to answer their questions and to acknowledge things in age-appropriate ways.
And yes, we definitely don't want to, you know, dive deep into the history of systematic racism or genocide with a first grader. Let's not do that to them. Just, you know, a simple comment like, Ma really doesn't seem to like Indians very much, does mm-hmm. she? Do you think that's okay? You know, mm-hmm. simple comments like that can sort of conceptualize what's going on with the book and start the student on that path of, oh, wait, just because it's in the book doesn't mean I have to accept it as the way the world is.
Mm-hmm. And this is where I feel like the classical progression shines, because if you're using a classical method for educating, these types of quick conversations are going to come very naturally because you're aligning your history and literature. So if you're reading Little House, maybe you're also studying Native American nations at the same time. And it's a lot easier to have that conversation when they have some context around it from their history studies. So that's just one of the reasons I love the classical progression so much. But they can be simple comments. Like you said, the age appropriate is key.
Age appropriate is key. And there is a caution that I would like to put in there. And I'm going to actually tell two stories on my mother right now. One is a thing that she did well, and one was a thing that drove me crazy. Okay. So when we were kids, and I'm offering this as a little bit maybe of a counterpoint to read the classics out loud with your kids, because mm-hmm. I can see parents who have six small children or parents who have children who read a lot incredibly fast mm-hmm. saying, I can't possibly read everything out loud.
Right.
I was a very fast, very early, very voracious reader. And I think my mother just gave up trying to keep up with me. Mm-hmm. And she gave up even trying to, you know, police what books I was reading, because I read so much. And so she would say, hey, when you're reading, if there's anything in the book that strikes you as odd or strange or that you want to talk about, just turn down the corner of the book and keep going. Mm. And that was so freeing because, mm-hmm. first of all, it said to me exactly what we've been saying, Suzanne, is that I could question the book. That just because I was reading it and it was in print didn't mean that I had to accept everything in it. I could ask questions about it. And then secondly, it told me that she was willing to talk about it without whipping mm-hmm. the book out of my hands and telling me never to read it again. Mm, you know, yeah. it was opening up a space where we could talk about these things. And I mean, I remembered I dog-eared a whole lot of books.
Wow.
And I thought that was such a great way to go about that. Then I'm going to give you something she did that didn't work so well. This wasn't actually a book. It was the first time that I ever saw the musical movie My Fair Lady. Mm-hmm. And it's the music is so lovely and it's so romantic. I mean, it's Audrey Hepburn and she looks like an elf. And it was just, I love that movie. I know. I was absolutely enthralled by this movie. I was deep into it. I was lost in the romantic dream. And my mother kept saying, don't ever be with a man who treats you that way. Okay. Now, again, as an adult looking back, I'm like, well, of course, you know, this is not a great love story. And the guy's kind of a jerk. But at the time, it annoyed me so much.
Right.
Because she kept interrupting the flow of the story to point out the thing that was wrong with it.
Yeah.
So I would encourage you as you do this to offer your comments either before or after, as opposed to interrupting the flow of the story. Because remember, I said that one of the great values in these books is their enduring storiness, you know, how great they are as imaginative works. So if you keep interrupting the story in order to point out something that's wrong with the worldview, you're kind of losing the story. You're losing the whole point of reading the book.
That makes sense. I think I remember reading with my mom. She would sit down with some of the older girls and read stories to us before bed. And I love just sitting there and listening. And from my memory, we would talk about it afterwards. Because like you said, it would be kind of
jarring
to stop in the middle. But even if you do have a kid who's a voracious reader and you can't really, you're just out of control with what they're reading, just having space at a meal once a day where you talk about, hey, what are you reading lately? How's it, you know? Just like your mom did, opening that place where they know they can have a conversation with you. I think it's really cool that you actually dog-eared them. They actually took her up on that. On that, because if you had felt like, oh, I shouldn't have read this. This is bad. Or there's something in here I shouldn't have seen. Mm-hmm. Then you would have hidden it, which is probably a little bit more of what I was doing. Mm-hmm. When I was in the same situation where I kind of outread my mom's ability to preview things. And then if I did read things that I maybe wasn't ready for or had questions about, I didn't necessarily feel like I had a place I could go. So I think opening up that space for kids is so, so awesome.
Yeah. I mean, having said that, there were definitely a few things I didn't dog ear or bring up, and they mostly had to do with sex. So we shouldn't necessarily expect, you know, this is going to solve all the problems.
No, not at all. And at the end of the day, reading about, I learned a lot about the world through reading, even as I was getting into middle school and high school, classics that dealt with adult themes. And I learned things I probably wouldn't have never learned any other way about different types of people and different jobs and professions I didn't know about before, to use some euphemisms here. But it didn't hurt me. It was still a safe way.
You're bringing memories back to my mind that I'm 100% not sharing with our listeners.
Okay. I feel like that's too big of a tease, but I think we should move on. Number one is reading out loud and or creating space for your kids to have conversations with you after you read, before.
Or before. You read. Yeah. Before, after. Yeah. I'm just putting out that little caution on the during.
Right. And then the second one aligns with that a little bit is do a quick Google search, you know, especially if you have kids who read a lot, you're not going to be able to preview every book your kid reads. It's just not realistic. You have so much going on, but you can quickly Google the Secret Garden or Peter Pan, and that way you're not surprised by what's in there. I remember reading in preparation for this an article by a mom who was listening to Peter Pan, I think it was, on audio in the car, and something came up and she was so completely taken aback, and she just didn't know even how to have the conversation in the moment because she wasn't expecting it. She remembered reading Peter Pan as a kid and didn't remember that being in there. So a quick Google search is a easy way to know what you're in for before you start reading out loud with your kids or before you plug in the audiobook.
Yeah. And you can actually, I mean, whatever your particular concern is, I mean, we should all be concerned if books are containing obviously racist or misogynistic or, you know, whatever elements, but you can search like the title, like if you search The Secret Garden objectionable or The Secret Garden racist or The Secret Garden depiction of women, just, you know, depending on what it is that you want to be particularly alert for, you're going to come up with immediately with, you know, a list of problematic scenes. And if you do, then if you're not, if you, you know, are going to give the book to the kid and say, you know, turn down the corner or use a post-it if it's a library book. I should add that we weren't allowed to turn down corners in library books. We, you know, but you can use a post-it. If the kid goes through the whole book and doesn't turn anything down, doesn't mark anything, doesn't have anything to discuss, then I think the appropriate follow-up would be to say, so, in this one scene, this character describes this other character with these words about how Indians look that seem very objectionable and racist and bad. And did you notice that? So using that Google tool can be a way of, again, alerting kids to look out a little bit more.
Yeah, it's kind of a cheat sheet to know what your kid is engaging with so that you can be ready for those conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then our third tip is to supplement.
And supplement, supplement, supplement.
Supplement, supplement, supplement. There's a lot of great books out there, and there's a lot of wonderful stories. When I was teaching, one year that I was teaching middle school history, we started the whole year watching this TED Talk called The Danger of a Single Story. And it's very, it's one of the most popular TED Talks, and I'll link it in the show notes. But our students kept coming back to that TED Talk every, almost every time we had a discussion about a particular time in history, because the theme of that TED Talk is that, you know, this, the speaker, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, is a novelist from Nigeria. And she talks about how she would send in manuscripts for publication, and the publisher or the agent or whatever would say, I can't publish this. It's set in Africa, but it's not African enough, because the main character was maybe upper middle class or middle class, or had nice things. And she was frustrated by that because she was from Nigeria. She was telling stories that were authentic to her lived experience, but they weren't quote, quote, African enough. And so she gets into how there are multiple stories of Africa that are true. And if your only understanding of Africa, for example, is that it's a monolithic continent full of impoverished people, then you're missing so much of the history, the culture, and the experiences, the lived experiences of people in Africa. And so, yes, poverty exists in Africa, but also there are middle-class people, and they have stories. So to not fall into this danger of there's one single perspective on a time or event or group of people. And so I think if you actually are teaching middle school and high school kids, it's a great TED Talk to start your year with. It can induce a lot of great conversations. But having that in mind as you're reading these books, like I mentioned earlier, if you're doing a classical education and you're supplementing reading, for example, Little House, with learning all about different Native Americans who lived on the frontier and different nations and how they were different and what languages they spoke and what their houses looked like and all these things, it's going to create a much easier way to have conversations when Ma and Pa make assumptions about Native Americans, because your children have more information about those people than Ma and Pa had.
Sure. And, you know, and I love this idea, just because then we don't sacrifice the lovely story because it's being told by a person of their time. And, and I do feel like this is something which is difficult to address with grammar stage children, but actually maybe not as hard as we think. The idea that a book is reflecting an attitude that we no longer find loving, that we no longer find kind, I think is something that even small children can understand. And I think a lot of families have an older relative who needs to be extended that kind of understanding, you know, because perhaps they are old enough to where they're not really thinking clearly anymore. And they say things that are troubling. And we want our children to know them because they're not going to be on this earth very much longer. But we're concerned about that. I think there can be a real benefit, even to young children, in trying to express to them that this is the way people spoke back then. It wasn't loving. It wasn't kind. And I would use the words loving and kind as opposed to bad, because I think a young child can understand that a little bit more easily.
Yeah.
And we don't use that language anymore because it's hurtful. I think that a book can even be a way into that. And this idea of not using a single story means that you can look at the book with its hurtful language, but then right. read from someone else's perspective and realize, okay, this is how we talk about it now. Mm-hmm. This is how they talked about it then. Look how right. different these two ways of speaking are.
Right. And as far as enriching their understanding of American history or history in general, like the Little House books, Ma and Pa and Laura, their experiences are very accurate to the time period from their perspective, from mm-hmm. their pioneer settler story. It shouldn't be the only thing about Native Americans your kids are ever exposed to when you're studying, you know, the West. But it is a story that's true, that they can understand. And then, like you said, they should be able to kind of differentiate between these different perspectives. And they are old enough usually, and this is where parental discretion comes in, but usually old enough to understand that, yeah, we don't, it's not okay to talk like that about somebody anymore.
Right.
But that's how right. That's what they did then.
Susanna, I'm curious about your own experience because mm-hmm. you know, talked about going and having a bonnet. So were you, insofar as you can cast yourself back into your 8-year-old mind,
right.
whatever it was, and you read them. I mean, they're obviously, you were identifying with the books in mm-hmm. a very important way, but do you yeah. think you were aware of the historical difference between you and them?
That's an interesting question. I very much felt connected to Laura, the character Laura. And Laura in the story,
she's scrappy.
She's fun. She's scrappy, a little mischievous. And all she wants to do in Little House on the Prairie, when they move out West, she wants to meet an Indian baby. She wants to see a Native American baby. Mm. And, there's this kind of, you know, I don't know the right word for it. You could see it as problematic if you see her intentions as just like this, it's this foreign, exciting thing. But what I remember from the books from when I was little was when she meets the Osage man, and there's another point in the series where he gives her a rabbit's foot, which is mm-hmm. a symbol of good luck. And she befriends this man who she was so scared of those people before, but then she meets somebody and he was really kind to her. And she always keeps that rabbit's foot around her neck. That's right. what I remembered. When I went back and read it again, there was so much that I don't know if it went over my head or I didn't remember. And so that's an interesting question because I don't remember walking away from the series with a negative idea of Native people. Maybe I had one and I just don't remember it. But what I remember was there are these people who were scary, and then she met one and he was mm-hmm. actually really kind to her.
Well, and as I recall too, when she meets the baby, she recognizes the baby as a baby, not right. as a quote unquote Indian, but as a baby.
Right.
And I think even Pa, because she says she wants to take the baby home.
Right, she does.
Reminds her that this is not a doll. This
right.
is a baby.
This is a person whose parents want her.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Your parents want to take the baby home. So, you know, there's some redemptive aspects to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I'm going a bit down a rabbit hole here. But
yeah, no, but I do, I think, because I would go out and play these stories out in the woods. And I think I took them and I did change them to my time and mix things in a little bit. And so I think I recently reread Treasure Island because that's one of my favorite books ever. And the whole time I was reading it, I was looking for the rich young woman whose father helped charter the ship, who stowed away in the ship because her father wouldn't let her go, but she wanted one last adventure before going to finishing school. And she ends up with the Motley crew and helps save them from the pirates. And I was like, I was reading it and she just never appeared and never appeared. Eventually I finished the book and she never appeared. And I realized I made her up. when I was laying out this story in the woods, I remember a scene where there was a young woman. And when I reread the book, it was all men. There was no girls in it. And so
Treasure Island Part 2.
Exactly. I was like, I just wrote a fan fiction when I was a kid in the woods. Fan fiction wasn't a thing yet, but I was already on it. So I think that in my imagination, I did sort of update things in a way and add to things. And always I did want to be like the good guy in history that had the right mindset about people, even when other people didn't. I do remember that. But
okay, so sorry, we're getting sidetracked here. So I think as part of this, avoid the danger of a single story, and I love that phrase so much, that you do, despite what I have said, which I stand by, that a lot of the more modern stories are not as engaging, do not have as much story quality, as much character development as the older books. But there are new books coming out all the time. And all of those books written from so many different perspectives give kids lots of options to what I think you've called windows and mirrors. Susanna, you want to talk about those two phrases?
Yeah, something that teachers talk a lot about in the context of finding books for their students or their classroom libraries is this idea that every kid should have access to both windows and mirrors in stories. So windows are books that allow a kid to look into a different world than their own and empathize with someone else's life experiences. So somebody who isn't like me, who lives in a different place, who has a different culture, who has a different skin color, and I'm reading a story about their life. And there are studies that show that reading literature actually helps develop empathy, which is pretty cool. So those are your windows. But students should also have access to mirrors. And this can be difficult if your entire reading program is classical children's literature and it's all about white characters and your kids aren't white, then there's no books about kids who share similarities with the reader, which allow a child to kind of place themselves in the story and see their own experience as important. And so we need both. Kids need to have books that take them to other worlds and books that reflect their own experiences.
I love that distinction.
There's really good lists out there curated by teachers, BOMs, just people interested in literature. And I'll link a few in the show notes too of note. Stories of Color, which is one that was brought up by our listener when she emailed us, is a curated list of a lot of picture books and children's literature books about, these would be about kids from different cultures, backgrounds. And there's also one that I'll link in the show notes called American Indians Children's Literature.blogspot.com. I'll put the link. And that is curated by a woman named Debbie Reese, who has done a ton of research into depictions of Native Americans, particularly in children's literature. And she has whole lists of like books that are really not accurate and things to avoid. And she also has lists of alternatives. And she, I'm actually not sure where she's from, but anyway, she's done a lot of research about this and is a great resource.
Yeah. So we'll put those in the show notes so that you guys can access them. And I really feel like that as we're moving on to sort of logic and rhetoric stage, the problem becomes less acute. Because we're going into these stages, and if you're not familiar with the stages, go back to season one, people. We explain classical education there. I'm waving my hand, which you can't see. By the time you get into the logic and rhetoric stages, you are actively trying to develop in students this more critical attitude where they are approaching books as artifacts of their time. Artifacts sounds really dead. But as productions of their time, written by people of the time. And so it becomes a little less complicated.
Right.
A logic and rhetoric stage student is not going to absorb the universe of the book in quite the same way as a grammar stage student. So, you know, the whole emphasis of classical education is in training students to, from the logic stage through the rhetoric stage, develop that critical faculty and think about whether or not the message of the book is something that they agree with. So definitely children's literature is the issue here.
Right. I would just say very quickly, with the logic and rhetoric stage, those things that we were already talking about still apply, about making space and time, showing your kids that it's okay to talk about it. I'm here if you want to talk, supporting them with resources to do further research when they see something that bothers them, or when they're looking at a source that does have historically outdated attitudes. But like you said, this is all going to fold and so beautifully with the classical education, because they're already doing that work of learning to evaluate sources from their time.
Yeah. So as you can tell, Suzanne and I both sort of come down on the better to read than not read side of things. But I would say there are definitely books that should be skipped. And I would say that actually the number one of these would be, and I'm sorry to pick on a particular era, 19th century history and historical fiction written for kids, which tends to be so, I mean, we're not talking about the story classics that have endured for generations, but a lot of parents tend to conflate old with good. So if you go to Project Gutenberg or there's a reprint service that I think is called Forgotten Books or something that reprints 19th century history and novels and such. If you are mining the 19th century because you think it's safe or good somehow, it's not. You're probably not going to get a lot of explicit sex. So, you know, that's one trap that maybe you're avoiding. But the attitudes in it are going to be so counter to what your child needs to learn to live in today's world that this is just not going to move your child along the path to clear thinking and wisdom.
Yeah, it's. I think an analogy might be like my parents liked us to watch TV shows like I Love Lucy and the Dick Van Dyke Show, not whatever was coming out at the time because it seemed safe. It was old, so it's probably good. But that doesn't necessarily mean it has literary value just because it's old. The classics are the classics for a reason. And there's a lot of old books that aren't that well written. And there are some new books that are well written. So that's not necessarily a good gauge to start with.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. So just because it's old doesn't mean it's good. Just because it's old doesn't mean it's safe. If it isn't a classic that has endured, there's probably a reason why. Right. And I mean, again, I'm not a fan, and I don't think you are either, Suzanne, of banning books or making them unavailable. I just wouldn't seek them out.
Right. Yeah. I had a few examples in my mind of books that I wouldn't stop my daughter from reading, but I wouldn't necessarily offer it to her as something that she must read or even encourage it. I think one of those would be books that she hates. Just because I read them and love them doesn't mean that she has to. So if there's a lot of wonderful books out there, a lot of wonderful classics. And just because I love Lauren Goes Wilder, if my daughter hates it, it doesn't resonate with her, we can move on. We don't have to go through every book in that series. Yeah. It's not worth it. I think another example would be modern books written more recently that kind of use different time periods as a backdrop, but don't really have any good research. They're not well written. They're wildly inaccurate. The first two that come to mind are the Indian in the Cupboard series and the Boy in the Striped Pajamas. Again, I wouldn't stop my kids from reading them, but I would probably have conversations with them about the historical inaccuracies because there are so many and they're not necessarily reflective of the author, but they're reflective of the author not doing enough research for writing a historical fiction novel.
How do we feel about Night in the Museum, which I realize is not a book?
It's not a book. It's a movie. I've only seen it once a long time ago, and I remember it being funny. But as a history major, I'm sure I had objections. It was a long time ago I watched it.
Well, sidebar, Night in the Museum. So I really think that a really important question to ask yourself is, and we can bring this back around to the Little House series, is how much of the book is affected by an attitude that you find repugnant? I mean, is the whole thing suffused with racism? Is it suffused with misogyny? Look, I loved That Hideous Strength. I really object when I reread it to its portrayal of women, but that's not actually the main thrust of the book.
Right? Yeah,
so
absolutely.
I don't avoid it. And I would say that in the Little House series, there's a whole series of books there. Certainly Little House on the Prairie, more than any of the others, is kind of suffused with this
attitude
towards Native Americans in particular that we find offensive. But the series as a whole is not. There is so much more in it about surviving. I mean, even is it in Little House on the Prairie that they have the blizzards and the locusts and the all of those things?
They go through so much in every book. There is a blizzard in Little House on the Prairie.
A lot of it is about survival, right?
Right.
So if you were to say, what is the theme of this book? I would pick survival. But if you read a book and you think actually the theme of this book is Native Americans are bad, then don't read the book.
Yeah, there's a, I think there's a difference between, and again, this is getting into tricky territory, but there's a difference between a book that's permeated with an idea and then a book that has these moments that you can mm-hmm. talk about. But if the attitudes of the characters are so deeply permeated with these ideas, the descriptions of the characters themselves are, you know, you have multiple characters that are just racist stereotypes, it's going to be a lot more tricky to have that conversation in the grammar stage. I probably wouldn't touch it.
Shall we call this the Huckleberry Finn problem?
Yes. Huckleberry Finn is an example of a book where there are characters who sort of represent different stereotypes. It's not an isolated moment or two. It's the whole character of Jim that is a stereotype. And so that's something that I would save for kids to be older and more equipped to analyze that type of idea because it's just who the character is.
Yeah, absolutely. And fortunately, Huckleberry Finn is old enough and difficult enough to where mm-hmm. your grammar stage child is not likely to encounter it, or your logic stage child for that matter. It's really mm-hmm. more of a high school book at this point. But that is a book that I think is actually so imbued with the idea of racial superiority of whites and inferiority of the enslaved Africans who live with the whites and make their lives possible, that I find that particular book, I find it difficult to argue that the literary merit of that book, that the story is worth immersing yourself in that particular mindset. That's just me.
Yeah. And I think people will have different books that feel like that to them. And again, this all comes down to parents knowing what they're getting into, feeling prepared to have these conversations, and knowing their children and their children's ability to engage with the content in the book. So I think it all comes back at the end of the day to your discretion, but hopefully some of these tips and ideas and points were useful as you are grappling with this in the same way that I am.
I hope so too, because I feel like we've spent a lot of time saying, this is hard, but you know what? I think there's a really useful space as a parent educator to sort of occupy that, to mm-hmm. say, this is hard. And the more that you can expose your children to that, the more they can see you grappling mm-hmm. with that, the more you can comment, again, before or after, but not during, the story about, I'm not so sure about that aspect of it. I'm not so sure that, you know, that that's something we would want to reproduce. I'm not so sure that that's kind and loving. I keep coming mm-hmm. back to the word kind because I think it's a useful one. Then, you know, the more freedom you have in a lot of ways right. to enter into the imaginative worlds that other people have created, including those people that, you know, if you had afternoon tea with them, you might leave it saying, oh, let's not do that again.
Letting your children be exposed to the world in safe ways. I do really feel like it may be hard, but it is worth the effort. It is worth the struggle to engage with these books, to enjoy the literary value of these books, and to have the difficult conversations that inevitably will come forth from them.
I absolutely agree.
And with that is the end of our episode for today. Please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on classical education, home education, school education, or any kind of education that interests you. You can reach us at podcast@welltrainedmind.com. Thanks for listening.